I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Haiti is looking for a new prime minister after Laurent Lamothe was forced to step down over the weekend. It's more turmoil for the country, which is still recovering from a devastating earthquake in 2010 and roiled by protests and allegations of political corruption. Coming up on Intersection, I'll talk with Florida author Ardane Ismer about his novel Midnight at Noon, which is set during a time of revolution in Haiti in the 1980s. I'll talk with Dr. Ismer about his novel, about Haiti's past and about the country's future. But first, the Florida Peninsula is filled with salt and freshwater seafood selections. Food writers Heather McPherson, Pam Brandon and Kate Farman travelled to the state to find the best of Florida's seafood dishes for their book Good Catch, recipes and stories celebrating the best of Florida's waters. Heather and Pam join me in the studio to talk about their travels and how you can enjoy the best of Florida's waterways at home. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Heather McPherson and Pam Brandon. Pam is a food writer for outlets like Edible Orlando. Heather is Orlando Sentinel's food editor and restaurant critic. Together, they've published a new book called Good Catch, Recipes and Stories Celebrating the Best of Florida's Waters. Heather and Pam, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, the book takes you all across Florida exploring the state's seafood scene, notable restaurants and hyperlocal ingredients. How long did it take to write the book?
We were on the road for at least more than a year. The book actually came from a prior book we did called Field to Feast. And as that, the seafood component of that book just started growing like Lake Okeechobee. It just wouldn't stop. And I actually texted Pam on my way back from Steinhatchee, which is a wonderful place to go scalloping on Florida's Big Bend, and said, I've been counting all the species, and I think we have a companion book. We were very fortunate. Our publisher said, let's go for it. So we spent a year promoting Field to Feast while we were beginning to write Good Catch. So a little over a year.
And we split the state into three areas. Mm-hmm. I headed south, Miami. Heather stayed in Central Florida and both coasts. And Katie headed to North Florida. So the three of us conquered the state in about a year.
Is there a good tradition of people appreciating seafood in Florida?
It's an incredible legacy we have, and we sometimes forget how much seafood is here. A lot of it gets exported, and so we loved telling the stories of our own shrimpers and fishermen who are not only feeding Floridians, but really feeding the world.
Mm-hmm. And there's really no other state like us. I mean, we have the Gulf of Mexico, we have the Atlantic Ocean, and then we have this fabulous heritage river that courses right through the center of the state. So our variety of seafood surrounded by water on all sides is a great story. We have historic fishing villages that are very much a part of the state. And a lot of people forget that before we had theme parks and resorts, sport fishing was, and today still is, a huge tourism draw to the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm. You've got some great old photographs in here. I'm looking at a photograph here of Ernest Hemingway. He's got a couple of, I think those are tuna, right?
I believe that's a sailfish on one and a tuna on the other in that photo.
Right.
Yeah, and his recipe in the book, you know, just like Field to Feast, we cover your entire menu. We have cocktails, we have appetizers and sides in addition to our main courses. And that is the original Hemingway daiquiri, which was created for him in Cuba and he, of course, brought it to the state of Florida.
This is the Papa Doble?
Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more tart than what you expect at a daiquiri at any resort in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Pam, in the course of writing this book, are you off seafood now, or have you eaten too much seafood? Or
I love seafood. I especially love Florida shrimp. Mm-hmm. It is the freshest, most delicious tasting. Katie loves grouper. I think you're a grouper.
I'm
fan
a grouper
too.
Girl. Yeah,
but no, we love seafood, and it's just so healthy and so good for you too.
And most people don't realize, you know, a shrimp was one. There are several surprises in the book, but how many species of shrimp there are in Florida?
Seven in Florida.
How are those species doing? I mean, I'm wondering if in the course of writing the book, you kind of bumped up against the environmental question, like, you know, sustainable fishing and making sure those species you're talking about survive.
As we tell everybody, eat locally. And if fish is in season in Florida, you're eating sustainably. Florida shrimp is a really, really healthy industry. And really, our Florida fisheries, they're fairly carefully monitored. So you know sort of what's in season and what's not. And they really do monitor the fishermen when they're out on the water as well. So we didn't come across And of course, the oyster industry in Apalachicola is really suffering right now, but there's a lot of work going on there as well.
Mm-hmm. Pam, talk a little bit, if you could, about what kinds of fish options there are for somebody who's inland and doesn't have access to the coast.
Well, some of our favorites in the book were, of course, I love the frog legs, the fried frog legs. We talked to frog giggers from the central Florida.
Frog giggers?
Yeah, they go out on a boat and they, you know, and I mean, it's a big business, but they're also just, it's a wonderful, you know, freshwater catch.
Mm-hmm. Blue crab.
Blue crab is another one that it was
catfish.
Just loved.
Oh.
Loved. Yep, catfish.
St. John's River, you'll find a lot of blue crab.
Mm-hmm.
Some in areas that it's not necessarily so brackish, but, you know, Florida blue crab is just wonderful. It's just
how big do they get?
They're not that big. That's why I don't love them, because they're a lot of work. I love the golden crab because it's really, really big and full of delicious white meat. But, yeah, really, frog legs and blue crab, I think, are the two freshwater.
And catfish.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people stay away from catfish. They fear the bottom feeder. They think it's going to be dirty. But there's wonderful places that you can find amazing catfish. You know, a lot of our recipes were inspired by local fish camps.
You have a great blackened catfish.
We do. We do. From a restaurant over in Donella, and it's called Stump Knockers. And Stump Knockers are actually a type of fish that would swim in and out of the Cypress Knees. And it's named for that, but they're known for their blackened catfish, and we got their recipe for it. It's so good.
And fried frog legs, we've got that recipe. We've got a lot of really fun, and what we've done really, because we're all journalists, we're not chefs, so they're really recipes for home cooks. They've all been tested in a kitchen. So every recipe in the book, we think that you can create an entire meal with these relatively easy recipes using super fresh Florida ingredients.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Pam Brandon and Heather McPherson. Together with Katie Farman, they wrote Good Catch, which is recipes and stories celebrating the best of Florida's waters. If listeners want to try some of these recipes at home, where would be a good one to start with, Heather?
Well, there's a wonderful shrimp and feta recipe that is on the table in 30 minutes. And that's going to be a product that you're used to, whether any kind of shrimp that you buy. And the feta gives it a nice tart flavor to it. And one of the reasons why I like that recipe is because it introduces you to Florida's historic fishing villages. That, of course, was inspired by the Gulf Coast and the Greeks of Tarpon Springs. But Florida has several historic fishing villages that are celebrated by the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. You can go over to Cortez, and they have a wonderful maritime museum there. And near Cortez, there's also a very interesting story that, mark our words, you're going to see this on fancy menus everywhere. There's an ingredient called Bartaga, and Katie discovered this. The person who was doing this, the Anna Maria Bartaga Company, was out to dinner at Thomas Keller's restaurant, the French Laundry, arguably the hardest restaurant to get a reservation with in the country, and he sees something on the menu called Bartaga. So he orders it, and he is very curious, and he's asking what it is, and they tell him it's salted cured mullet roe, and they're importing it from Italy and France. And he's thinking, I come from Anna Maria, where we can just hold our hands up and catch a barrel full of mullet. Mm-hmm. Why are we importing this? Goes back to the Gulf Coast and starts this business, employs local fishermen, and it has this sort of umami, that sixth flavor. Mm-hmm. It's really wonderful. I've had it recently in the state of Florida, instead of anchovies, on a Caesar salad. And that was the first time I had heard of this, too. But this is starting around the country. And now we have a young entrepreneur in the state of Florida who's making sure that it doesn't have to come from Italy or France. Mm-hmm. We have plenty of mullet here. And they actually take the roe sustainably so that, you know, the fisheries continue as well. And I think exploring our own backyard is something people who have lived here for several generations don't always get a chance to do.
Mm-hmm. Pam, because you were pretty excited about the frog's legs, was that something that you ate a lot of before you started writing the book, or was it something you kind of came to as part of the process of writing it?
You know what? I had tasted them, but it wasn't something that we had a lot of. And so we used a local chef here, Jamie McFadden. He came as we were doing photography and came over and gave us his recipe for that, because there are some things we weren't sure about. For instance, we do a whole salted fish, a sheep's head in the book, but it's just such an easy recipe and it's really beautiful. You pack the fish in salt and roast it, crack the salt, which is really pretty as you serve it, and the fish is, it's not salty at all because it just keeps it steamed and fresh. So those sorts of recipes that you might be a little bit intimidated to try. And then things like, you know, a simple fried grouper sandwich, which is like the best. If you just get super fresh grouper, fry it, serve it on a nice soft bun with lettuce and a little mayo, and it's just the best. So the recipe, the book really does cover everything from a sort of a fancy dinner party to a simple sandwich, and the desserts are fantastic too.
Mm-hmm. And talking about the idea of going to local places, maybe a fishmonger rather than a big supermarket, looking to talk to somebody who knows a bit about the fish rather than getting from the frozen aisle, are you fighting, you know, is it an uphill struggle to try and get that message across to diners, or are people pretty receptive to that?
You know, it's a learning process, and I think we're all, even, you know, our big grocery stores like Publix, the fishmongers there will let you know when things are fresh, and the fish now all says where it's coming from, and if it doesn't, it should. I just think it's a process of, you know, education, and I think all of us are wanting more and more to know where our food is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Heather?
I think that we, you know, the education process is teaching people how to buy fish. That whole fish with looking you in the eye can be very intimidating rather than other proteins that you're going to find in a supermarket. So within the book, we have told you, you know, trying to explain what that clean ocean smell is, what you need to be looking for, engaging that person behind the counter so that you're getting the right cut, discerning grouper from bassa catfish, all of that sort of stuff. It is a little bit of an uphill battle because fish tends to be pricey in certain places, and it's the one thing a lot of home cooks are a little afraid they're going to mess up. And so we've kind of held their hand, I think, with many of the recipes. Pam and Katie and I have real lives. All these recipes are triple tested because we don't want people to be then afraid of grouper, which is a very, very pricey fish, or snapper, or any other thing that they bring into their home. We want them to feel a sense of accomplishment at the dinner table, and hopefully it'll become a new family favorite and we'll educate a new generation.
Let me ask you about another character in this book. This is Bill McCoy, and he's got a little description here. It's pretty entertaining. Halifax Historical Museum, you've got an excerpt from the book saying he was an accomplished boat builder and captain, 6 feet two, shoulders like a cargo hatch, slim waist, a voice like a foghorn, lean tan face, steady eyes and a weather-beaten face from long gazing over glittering waters. It's a nice little poetic description there. And there's a drink that goes along with him called the Rum Runner. What's the history behind this?
Well, Bill McCoy is actually, if you watch Boardwalk Empire, Bill McCoy's a real person.
Uh-huh.
He actually was a non-drinker. But he didn't like, this is like during Prohibition, he liked to build boats, he liked fast boats, and he didn't like the government telling people what they could and could not do. And he created this empire of running this rum outside the legal limit, and probably was one of Florida's most colorful characters. And a lot of people don't realize he did this really from a home base in Holly Hill in Volusia County, when they see, you know, grand productions like Boardwalk Empire. I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that the man did not drink, but he is responsible for keeping the rum trade up, you know, in this country during Prohibition. So the Rum Runner is a tribute to him. We wanted to tell these stories like we did with Hemingway and Bill McCoy of these people who were important to our lifestyle that involves the water. Pam found one of the greatest fishing guides, he's not alive anymore, but Jesse Lindsay, who was in Ponce Inlet, correct?
Yes, and he was, a Floridian, a native who took fishermen from all over the world out into the water, could pick up a boat and carry it. And he also, what we loved was that if you were late to go fishing with Jesse, he was in a hammock, and he didn't get out of the hammock. You were just done for the day. Mm-hmm. He was very, very serious about his fishing. But, yeah, great stories. I mean, Florida's got such an incredible history on the water and, of course, with farms, as we found in Field of Feast. But
right.
It was great fun to find these characters.
Mm-hmm. We even woven in, we have another, most people know what a fan I am of Marjorie Kennan Rollins and Desi Prescott, who basically taught her how to live in the scrub around Cross Creek. I had the pleasure of knowing Desi before she passed away, and I would go to her house on the Withlacoochee on weekends, my husband and I, and we'd cook and make various things, and Desi loved deviled crabs, and I think she got tired of making them, but she'd always ask me to make deviled crabs, and I would say, and she'd never give me her recipe, and I would keep making them, making them. I said, is this close to yours? And she goes, you've almost got it right. Make it again next weekend. So we have Desi's deviled crabs in there as best as I could come close to her recipe. But this is someone who really taught, you know, someone as important in Florida's literature and history, Marjorie Kenyon Rollins, about the Okalawaha, the important when it did go right out into the St. John's River and stuff. And that's a lifestyle and a culture we don't want to lose. And we wanted to get all of that, including this wonderful bounty from these nets down on paper.
Do you think that lifestyle, that idea can be preserved, though? Or is it, are you kind of trying to set something in amber here? Or do you think that people can kind of continue to...
I think they can. I really do. I mean, fishing is a great family adventure. You know, you don't have to buy an expensive boat. You can charter one for the day. You can fish from the shoreline of the St. John's River. You know, if you're in Volusia County on the lake line at Edstone Park, you can drop your line in the water. It's a great activity. And yes, I think it is. I think the state of Florida has done a great job of preserving these historic fishing villages around, you know, around the state. And trying to get people to go out there to do it, it is worthwhile. Pam and I and Katie were recently at a symposium. We mentioned the Gulf of Mexico, and people kind of have their eye on it right now. And one of the things that we learned from all the experts is that right now it is the most tested body of water. I mean, as Pam said, we just don't know what's going to happen in two or three or four generations. But right now, everything out of there is fine. And I think Florida has just you cannot not embrace this nautical lifestyle, even from Orlando. If you just fly in and you look as you're flying in and getting lower and you see pond after pond after pond, and you can tell the ones that aren't the sinkholes, not the perfectly round ones, and you see that gorgeous ribbon of the St. John's River, you have to embrace it to become a Floridian.
Aside from the frog legs, Pam, what are you, some of your favorite recipes in here?
Oh, gosh. And I love some of the desserts, actually. I love the salted caramel chocolate cake. That's a really good one. The chocolate peanut butter pie from the Rod and Gun Club. That was a fantastic trip down to the 10,000 Islands. And we talk about Florida, too. A lot of places are, you know, preserved, and you can get out and feel like you are hundreds of miles away. Certainly down 10,000 Islands is where the Everglades sort of seeps out into the Gulf. And it's just such a beautiful place to go out with a guide and fish or learn about the environment. Lake Okeechobee for bass fishing. So there's just, you know, the part of the journey and talking to the fishermen about their recipes. But yeah, I sort of am a sweet girl too, so I did love some of our desserts. Desserts and cocktails as well as the fish in the book.
Yeah, we do like the cocktails. Those were fun. But some of the sides, I mean, there was, we actually, Goodrich's, which is in Edgewater, Florida, which is just south of New Smyrna Beach, is this very, very, you know, plain Jane fish camp type of place. And my husband and I had discovered it years ago and been going there. And one day we ran into one of the, arguably one of Central Florida's top chefs, Scott Hunnell, from Victoria and Albert's. He and his wife, who was also a chef, were there. And you know that if you get one of the area's top chefs at this fish camp, the food's got to be good. And he is raving about their onion rings and how fresh the fish was. And we just love little stories like that, which part of it was happenstance. So for Goodrich's, we have their onion ring recipe, and we had Pam got the recipe from them. We experimented a little bit, but you know, it's the story of Florida food is so fascinating. I don't think we could ever get bored of it. Do you, Pam? I mean, it's just,
it's simple, fresh, local is really the secret to almost every recipe in the book.
I've been speaking to Pam Brandon and Heather McPherson. They are co-authors, along with Katie Farmand, of Good Catch, Recipes and Stories Celebrating the Best of Florida's Waters. Pam, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
And Heather McPherson, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. Archived interviews are available at WMFE.org or on WMFE's smartphone app, available for iOS and Android. Coming up after the break, conversation with Professor Ardane Ismer about his book Midnight at Noon. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm joined by Dr. Ardane Ismer. He is the author of Midnight at Noon. Dr. Ismer, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, I wonder if you could read the first paragraph of the prologue of your novel here.
For sure. Dusk fell. This was the mad magic of day shifting to night. The sun made its fleeting stain before melting into the horizon. From the yucca fields and banana plantation, the first notes floated of the cuckoo prelude, and in nearby bogs, the peepit frogs turned up. In the evening twilight, the hibiscuses shut the blossom, while nat-blooming jasmine embalmed the air, shooting out a fragrance strong enough to tenderize all statistic heart hidden in the foliage. First Worcester effectively ordered his hands to hit the mango branches for another long, fearsome night. Days in the tropics always close with a slam.
I love that last phrase there, days in the tropics closing with a slam, sort of night falling all of a sudden there. It's a very kind of visceral image of I suppose, just the kind of Haitian environment.
Exactly. And especially when you're talking about the countryside.
Yeah.
You know, when it's dark mm-hmm. until the first light again breaks.
But things change quite quickly after this. I mean, this novel is set in a time of revolution. And mm-hmm. what time period are we talking about here?
We're talking about the period right after the Duvalier fled the country in 1986. It was a period that many historians called it the Bamboche Democratique, which is like some sort of a party democracy. And that's when the country was trying to seize the moment to create a true society with democratic governance and the rule of law. But somehow the understanding of that was quite different. It depends on who you talk to, the political party, you know, that you were dealing with. So, and things really quickly fell apart, as everyone remember. Mm-hmm. Between 86 to 90, it was a rocky period of various coups and counter-coups and until the 1990 when the international community set up a governing body to oversee the first democratically elected government, which was at the time the Aristide government.
Who are you writing this novel for?
The target audience for this specific novel is mainly Haitian Americans, younger folks, like my daughter, born and raised in the United States, but very few were not quite knowledgeable about the history of their country except for what the parents really are telling them. Mm-hmm. And then the majority of the times, also, most parents simply tend to tell them what, you know, their personal experiences, but not the whole history of Haiti. Mm-hmm. But if you read this novel, you would see why this country have gone somehow from bad to worse. And when you think you hit the bottom, and the bottom drops. That's the first audience. The other one, of course, is anyone who would be interested in the history of Haiti, understanding why this country seems to be unable to find its way out of this tragic situation.
Now, your main character,
Odilon.
Odilon. Mm-hmm, so exactly. He is a young person who's kind of thrust into a situation, not by choice, but basically by circumstances.
Circumstances, exactly. He was just a regular peasant, as you could see, coming home from work, but just could not understand why his brother was taking, just to please such a maniac police section chief. Mm-hmm. You know, and since then he's been trying to find revenge. And he in the Revolution Square, so he seemed to have found it. Mm-hmm. And the person of Zubeda, who's the revolutionary leader. And of course, that's when he began to understand the complex problem of society. In other words, where you're from or where someone is born does not really determines the person you will be. Who you are is far greater than where you're from.
And the scene where he sees his brother getting taken away and essentially kidnapped by the local police.
Yes.
That's fiction, but it seems like it's based in something which may have happened.
A daily routine. I've mm-hmm. witnessed it myself. I was born in Haiti and left when I was 17. So many injustices. People over time seem to think it's normal. But as you get older, so you know that he wasn't normal at all. You know, when a peasant is taking a prisoner, it's not very easy to reverse this type of injustices.
Talk to me a little bit about the character in the book called Tijon. Am I getting that name right?
Tijon. You know what? You're not the first one, Matthew, who asked the question. The description of Tijon fits the character of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But I don't think that Aristide is that cruel, although he's done many wrongs, many, many wrongs, because when he was elected in 1990, he was elected on the premise to lift the country, if I want to quote his own word, from misery to poverty with dignity. In fact, of course, we know a few months later he was overthrown and a military junta took over. But when he was brought back to the country, it was not the same Aristide that we knew. He was an entirely different person.
What about Haiti now? Do you get the sense that there's hope for Haiti being able to get past some of the problems that have plagued it?
It's very hard to actually say. Let me give you an example. You know, the earthquake completely devastated the entire capital city. And the whole structure of government effectively collapsed. And here we are since 2010. We're in 2014, at the end of 2014. You go down to Port-au-Prince right now, the structures still remain crumbled. I mean, you tell me, if you claim to be a leader and you really want to lift this country from its deplorable situation, and 4 years later, you seem to be unable to find a way to at least to put the country on the path to reconstruction, then there is a problem. They try to blame the international community for reneging on the promise that they made at the beginning, but of course Haiti is a country also. Haiti claims to be an independent country. Independence means just that, independence. Of course, you need the help from the international community. You need the help from the NGOs and all the philanthropic organizations. But at the end of the day, it's the Haitian government that has to set the tone for national reconstruction. Unless you have a program, you have a platform, and you have a crisis government dealing with the major problem, maybe 5 years from now, we can still be sitting down, Matthew, talking about it, and the country will still be in the same situation.
What do you hope readers take away from your book?
What I would hope is that through this book that you'll find out the history of misery of a people yearning for justice. But the Haitian story is a mirror reflection of story of disenfranchised people around the world.
I've been speaking to Dr. Ardane Isma. He is the author of a new novel, Midnight at Noon. It's about a time of revolution in Haiti. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Matthew.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. You can follow him at Brendan L. Byrne on Twitter. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.